David Lee Roth on 92.3 Free FM.
A woman I know took for my best friend. Some joker got lucky, stole her back again. He better come on in my kitchen. It's fun to be running out of. A woman I know took for my best friend. Some joker got lucky, stole her back again. He better come on in my kitchen. It's fun to be running out of. A woman I know took for my best friend. Some joker got lucky, stole her back again. He better come on in my kitchen. It's fun to be running out of.
Roth Radio, DLR here. Animal, tell a little bit of that story one more time. Go ahead, put the microphone up. Go ahead, man.
Oh, man, the music kind of got me a little bit, man. Made me think about my homie, man, you know. But like I was saying, man, you know, like where I'm from, you know, like when you're OG, you know, Crips and Bloods do get along, as long as you don't disrespect nobody. And we learn that getting our name and stuff. You get a certain age and everything is cool. But when you're a youngster, you know, you're trying to get the name for yourself. And that's what we thought it was. You know, how can you get your name by taking out a big time OG, you know? And that's what we was thinking on. But it turned out it wasn't that. It was this girl. She kind of smelled the latest perfume on him, and they got into a discrepancy, and then she took him out, man.
She shot him twice in the chest.
Yeah, she did, man.
And he's dead now.
Yeah, he's dead now, man.
And is she incarcerated, or is she on the street?
They let her out of jail yesterday, man, on bail or something like that, they was telling me. But, you know, and I guess her story was like self-defense or something. I don't know. But anyway, my homie, he got some mean cousin girls, man, might not, you know, take to a kind of her just getting out of jail like she got away with something, and she may not even make it to court, you know. That's just how serious
it is.
Is
she Crippin' as well? She part of the gang as well?
Yes, she was, you know. She was OG too, you know. But you got them youngsters, man, just don't give a F, you know. They just want to get their name, and then they can get with us to tell the stories after the dust settled, you know. That's basically what it's all about.
So you lost a friend. When did he get shot?
They told me yesterday, so it happened Tuesday night.
There's your reality series.
Yeah.
It's a little different than the series Rockstar.
Yeah,
that's,
man,
a game show. That's a competition.
Yeah.
That's reality. I told you, you tuned to this show, you're going to get something that you have never heard before.
Yeah. But I want to tell you another little story. I've been trying not to tell you this all week, but I might as well go on and tell you. It's Friday, man. Our favorite water hole got closed up Tuesday also, man. There's no more crazy girls, man. They sold the club. And it has a lot to do with me, too, man. A big fight.
Okay,
happened on
stop
Christmas
right
Day.
There. I know what happened. I don't want to hear it over the radio.
But anyway, man, it's no more. I thought
I
would.
Well, it certainly goes with the music, huh?
Yeah.
That's the most colorful story I've heard in a while here. Let me read this and see what you think on this. California gang members to be tracked by GPS. California prison officials have begun using global positioning systems anklets to track down gang members. The gritty suburb of San Bernardino, you know exactly where that is, about 60 miles east of Los Angeles. You live there?
Yeah, that's where I lived at when I got, well, you know, like, something else happened when I used to live in Compton. I really didn't tell nobody that because of what happened. My aunt got killed in the process, so I had to go to San Bernardino to live with her daughter, which is my cousin and stuff. So I lived there.
How did your aunt get killed?
Drive-by. Yeah, drive-by. And it was something, you know, it had something to do with drugs, you know, like her son, you know, he got into drugs and everything. And they were smoking crack one night. And when the pipe got to him, he didn't have his blast. So he freaked out and shot the dude in the head, blowed his brains out everywhere. And these guys, he grew up with them, so evidently they knew where he stayed at. So they came by the house that night about 3 o'clock in the morning, knocked on the door. My Aunt Pauline came to the door and said, "Who is it?" And they just sprayed the whole house with Uzis, and she died through the shootout. I used to have a clipping for a long time, but it messed with me so much I tore it up. Man, I used to cape it, you know, but I got rid of it. Yeah.
Go to the loop, man. Go ahead. Okay, Lynn, let's pick this subject up. California prison officials have begun using global positioning system anklets to track down gang members. The gritty suburb of San Bernardino, about 60 miles east of L.A., you just heard the story there, this week became the first California city to use the GPS satellite navigation system to track gang members. When the devices were strapped onto three parolees, State Department Corrections spokeswoman said six California counties began using GPS to monitor sex offenders in 2005. Some have already been arrested for violating parole after they were tracked to off-limit uses. GPS tracking, just another tool in the bag. We still use ground personnel to track gang members, she said. Another spokeswoman for Corrections Department says arrangement between prison officials and San Bernardino high-risk parolees known to belong to street gangs will be released from custody on the condition that they wear a GPS bracelet on their ankles at all times. What do you think about that?
Hey man, that's good, but there's a way around it if you know what to do, you know, because I had a friend that had one of them on it, and we knew how to like fix it up for they couldn't
stop right
it.
Here you are the most amazing.
I'll tell you off the air though, I won't say it on the air, because they could do it. It's so easy and simple to do it. I could put one on, they could never find me unless I wanted them to.
I can't beat that, man. So what you're saying is that it's going to go around the hood, that here's how you take this off the ankle and you can make your way around like Uncle Junior in The Sopranos, right?
But not too many people know about it. You know, it's kind of like, you know, certain people know about it, you know, and I'm one of the ones that know about it.
Okay. Nevertheless, what do you think about the practice? Do you think that this is going to create a civil rights issue, or is this something that's long time coming? What do you think?
I think it was long time coming for sex offenders. Those guys, when you mess with little kids, man, I think they should suffer the horrible death possible. You know, because they're just little kids, man. And I don't see how anybody can be attracted to a little kid, because they just bust a big ring around the United States a couple of days ago. A guy was wanting to have
sex.
I saw that too.
But what about for gang members? Are they in the same kind of league? Because they're talking about the same kind of a correctional approach.
Yeah. Well, I would guess it would be their activities or what they were accused of, I would say. But if it wasn't too hard, I kind of wouldn't agree, but they like murders or whatever, robbing, banging, and all that kind of stuff. I think it probably would be a good idea just to know what it is, just for, you know, safekeeping and stuff.
Especially,
you know,
with the kind of history you've experienced, huh?
Yeah, some crazy history behind me. You know what I'm
saying?
Oh, man.
866-313-3733, DavidLeeRoth.com, worldwide here. You just heard Animal's colorful tale here. That's the reality series you will never see on television. Tell us what you think about this. Is there a civil rights issue here? Are we headed towards 1984 George Orwell style? Seriously, because where do we draw the line as far as who gets the bracelet and who doesn't? If you're just a crip and you got caught for boosting a couple of cars, should you now be up on the GPS system? Should they be able to track you? If you're just in the gang, or like Animal says, it is a question of violent lifers, that kind of a thing. If you used a firearm, for example, a grand theft, armed robbery, you know, something like that, something life-threatening to other people, I might understand that. My fear is that just by identification, all right, just by simply having a tattoo, even somebody like yourself who may have had an affiliation and still only receives phone calls, obviously you're not banging now, you're a broadcasting star.
Yeah.
But just because somebody gave you a phone call, yeah, you know, I can download all your phone calls easily. Within a half an hour, I can tell you who you've been speaking to and how long you spoke to them, right?
Yeah, you can do that. But I'm telling you, you know, some of the main sergeants in our clique called me, you know, and that's when I knew it was really serious, you know.
Sure.
And it was like, man, you might have to suit up, man.
Okay,
like,
well then,
up, man.
Imagine if the FBI or somebody is now, you know, your friend is wearing an ankle bracelet, okay, and they say, well, he's wearing a bracelet, let's research every single person that they're talking to, okay? They come up with you. They go, did you ever have an affiliation? You go, sure. Now you got a big problem. Now you have to retain an attorney or whatever. So my question is where do you draw the line? Who gets the bracelet and who doesn't? You follow? Do you agree that there's different levels of gang members? I mean, obviously, a little peewee who's 12 years old is
the worst. He's the worst guy you ever want to meet. He's like a menace to society from like 12 to about like 16 or 17.
Okay.
You do not want to run up on one of those guys.
Okay. Well, then I was going to raise that question to you as well. It younger ages, are they less likely to cause trouble because you say they're kids? But right off the bat, you go, no. The peewees are the most dangerous, right?
They are.
Okay. Interesting already. 866-313-3733. Go ahead. You're in the spotlight. You're talking to David Lee. Go ahead, friend.
Hi. Am I on there?
Yeah, you're on. Go ahead.
Oh, cool. They are parolees, and therefore, they have limited sets of rights because they are not released, as in they've served their time. They are parolees, meaning they've been given early release, and they have to confine themselves to a very strict set of rules. So tagging them would not be a violation of their civil rights because they're basically being released from the prison facility, but still sort of in prison.
So are you reflecting that this is something that's going to be adopted for all parolees who are felons beyond a certain level of crime?
I don't think that would be unreasonable. I don't know that it would be done simply due to cost. I'm sure you see in general, correctional facilities and post-correctional facilities don't generally either have the correct attitude or have the money to try to reform and or watch after people who've committed crimes.
Nevertheless, in city centers like Los Angeles, you know, when you have places like Compton immediately adjacent, or, you know, here where the boroughs are very closely connected to New York City, or Manhattan, rather, then there is a conglomeration. There's a pattern, a cluster, okay? It happens in a concentrated form, as opposed to the great outdoors in the Midwest, all right? And I could certainly see where the government, you know, or whoever, you know, the local legislature would come up with the kind of funds for this, because it's right on the tip of everybody's tongue. All you got to do is put on hip-hop television, and all you got to do is put on the movies. What's happening in the magazines, on the magazine rack, is this culture. And I could easily see where any affiliation with gangs can become a contact for this, regardless of what you're on parole for. Do you feel that somebody who's there for Grand Theft Auto on their first bus should wear a tag?
Somebody who's there on their first bus, who doesn't have a long rap sheet, doesn't seem to have some sort of violent crime, I don't know that it would be worth it. I think that'd probably be overkill.
Who are you? You sound like you speak with some versification in this.
Well, I have experience with the penal system, not personal, from internal, from working around it, rather.
Okay.
And I've seen the penal facility inside, I've seen outside, I've seen alternative systems such as boot camps, drug rehabilitation as opposed to incarceration, etc. So I have some involvement, peripheral involvement, of course.
Okay, so you think this is a good idea then, as long as it's a violent subject?
Well, I think that as long as it's used appropriately, as anything, I mean, any power, as you can see with what's going on with George Bush, any power basically can be abused. But if it's applied appropriately, I actually see it as being a positive, because it would allow in general, the monitoring system for most people on parole is extremely poor. Okay, many people on parole will go quite a long time without seeing the parole officer. In fact, in the state of New York, the average visit or meeting with a parole officer is less than once a month, because you actually talk to a computer now. You sit down in front of a computer and answer questions.
We've just had an issue here with the bouncer who raped this little girl and killed her was a parole violator, if I'm not mistaken. He was being held over at Rikers. Everybody knew he was a parole violator. He had what's called body by Rikers. You can tell already he had a long history of being incarcerated. And he was already in lockdown when they finally figured out what was going on here. So I'm in agreement with you here.
I mean, so therefore, if you, now that wouldn't have prevented this crime in particular that you're referring to. However, if you have people that you know have a extended history of violence, okay, or an extended history of extreme crime, and they're being released on parole, meaning they're not free citizens yet, okay?
How long does the average parole last for? How long does that last for somebody who's done a violent crime?
It can vary greatly. It depends on what they're accused of, or convicted of, I should say. Parole tends to be much longer than the incarceration, unless the incarceration was pretty extreme. So, like, for a year of jail, you might do 3 years of parole.
But what you're saying is that the parole is no great arm on somebody. That the way it's run now, and because of perhaps that the system is super overloaded, that there's a lot of loopholes. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's totally super overloaded. It's not physically possible. I mean, if you look at the number of people we put in jail, okay, that's the reason parole exists, because we can't actually house everybody we sentence to prison. Therefore, we have to release people prior to the end of their sentence. Parole was originally invented with the concept of, well, there are some people who straighten up before they're sentenced. You
know, do we still think that?
We don't use it that way. I'm sure there are some people for whom that applies to. Can't say that they're, you know, you can't generalize too much. But,
well, I think we just learned something here. Thanks so much. We're going to go to the commercials. Don't go away. All right, let's go!
David Lee Roth on 92.3 Free FM.
I'm in the phone booth. It's a one across the hall. If you don't answer, I'll just ring it off the wall. I know he's there, but I just try to call. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got special guests calling on the phone today. Her name is Deborah Harry. She's from Blondie. They were just inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Deborah, are you there?
I'm here. I'm still in shock.
Are you still in shock about actually winning the award, or that you finally won the award?
All of the above. But I really need some medical technician.
Let me ask you this. Did you expect truly that you would be inducted into the Hall of Fame? All of us who are your fans, of course, did. But as the artist herself, did you expect that you would reach the highest point here?
Climb every mountain.
I'll hum it while you answer. Sail every... Go ahead, sweetie. What happened on that stage there with these two guys who popped up there and insisted on playing? I had a Sammy Hagar moment there.
Yeah, we all have them, I guess. You know, you do it long enough, and you know, certain relationships work out, and certain relationships don't.
Okay, and what happened? You went off on your own at one point there. You started writing, and were you actually writing from the very beginning, Deborah? I'm talking to Deborah Harry from Blondie here.
Yes, I have been writing from the very beginning.
And
people actually tried to keep all the pens and pencils out of my hands, but, you know.
Not a whole lot of luck there, huh? When you're talking about on tour, you're leaving to go out with the new Cars. Are you guys going to do a national issue here, Deborah?
Yes, we are. We're doing North America. We haven't done it for a couple of years, and it's we're looking forward to it a lot. It's going to be a good show, I think.
What can we expect to see you doing? What kind of material are you going to be doing?
Blondie material, a couple of cover songs. I think in the last English tour, we did a cover of Roxy Music's song "More Than This."
Okay,
usually throw something in.
Are you as popular outside the United States, dear, as in the United States? I got to imagine that you absolutely are.
Yeah, we actually started out internationally before we did before we came over here. So it's sort of, you know, like sometimes that happens in reverse.
Oh, that's the coolest way to go. That's the Jimi Hendrix story. What country supported you the most before United States latched on? This is interesting.
Yeah, the first place that we had a number one hit was in Australia, and then England. And so the sort of the British Empire, the remains of the British Empire, really embraced us for some reason.
Oh, well, we all know the reason. Obviously, it's the music and, you know, what you brought to it visually here. Have you seen a lot of imitators since then?
What?
Have you seen a lot of people imitating what you started off doing?
Those bastards!
Imitation is not the best form of flattery, huh?
No, it is. I'm just, you know, kidding around.
So what might...
It's great. I mean, we imitate. Who doesn't imitate? If you don't imitate, how are you going to get it together?
When you started off in the band, what was the material that you all were listening to that compelled you to go ahead and create what you were doing? What was on the disc when you decided to put Blondie together?
I don't know. I guess we listened to a pretty big cross section of things. You know, I think Chris was really heavily influenced by Jimi Hendrix and the Stones and that kind of stuff. And I, of course, was very influenced by the R&B, you know, girl singers, and you know, absolutely adored the rock goddesses of the 60s.
Which ones of the goddesses of the 60s were you talking about?
Janis Joplin.
Oh, okay. Well, you certainly have the attitude, but your voice is very, very different there.
Totally different. Totally different.
You have a unique sound. How's your voice holding up these days?
I think it's holding up. It's holding up pretty well. I think, actually... You know, I got smart in the last inning. I got smart, and I started working with a vocal coach. And do you know who Diamanda Galas is?
I know the name. Tell us who that is.
She actually turned me on. She abuses her voice in the most extraordinary ways, and she does these really far-out performances. So I said to her, you know, how do you do this? And she gave me her little secret. So I started working out with this vocal coach, and it was the best thing that I've ever done.
Well, it certainly makes a difference, doesn't it? I started off with vocal coaches, and I still periodically run to that. Even just talking here for 4 hours makes the big strain. You still like the road?
One of the things that they told me is that if you're sitting down when you're talking, it's really hard on you. You should be, you know, walking around or standing up.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. We do this entire four-hour show standing up throughout the entire... No, really, I'm standing up now as we speak for exactly that reason. And they gave me a lot of trouble about that. No, all disc jockeys sit down. All the great ones sit down. You know, all the great ones have kind of fallen apart. Do you still like going on the road? Is that still an attractive thing for you, Deborah?
Well, you know, there's nothing like playing for a live audience.
Who's in your audience now? What's the draw a picture of your audience for us?
What?
Draw a picture of your audience for us. What's your audience look like?
I don't usually see much further than the first couple of rows, honestly, David.
Especially by the 15th gig, huh? How many shows are you guys going to do?
Well, we're looking at 30 right now. I was told in the beginning there were, you know, prophesizing 40 shows. And so we're approaching that now, I think.
This sounds exciting. What are you listening to today? I'm talking to Deborah Harry from Blondie. What are you listening to today? What are the top three things that, or do you even bother to listen? Some people change.
Yeah, no, I've been writing, so I haven't been listening. The only time that I really listen is when I'm in the car.
Ah.
And then I surf, so... I really like to see what's going on.
Okay. And when you say that you're writing, sweetie, do you use a musical instrument, or are you working just primarily with lyrics and an instrumentalist?
I usually work with, I start writing like on a theme, and then I try to develop like a rhythm pattern, and then I just work to the rhythm without really a melody, and then sometimes the lyrics will suggest a melody or a mood, and it develops from there. Other times I work with a guitarist, all the above. I try to mix it up.
That's an interesting way of going about composing a song here. You're working with a track without actual chord changes, and then you start with the groove, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I really think that's great. That always has been really a big turn on for me, you know, to get that thing going, that rhythm, that groove. And to me, that is always there's always a melody in there.
Well, it's certainly a lot closer to what's happening now on the pop charts and in hip-hop particularly, huh?
Yeah, I guess so.
There's more of that tempo there. And what do you think about all the new modern technology that comes in with sampling and all that kind of material? You know, when you started out, it was very much organic instrumentation. And now you've got all the synths and the Pro Tools and the home production and, like I said, samples and loops. You like working with that kind of stuff, Deborah?
Yes and no. You know, I think there's a good side to it, and then you certainly lose some kind of I don't know, sort of freak accidents that occur, you know, in spontaneity, which is really, you know, that's the real inspiration.
How much of your best work has been an accident? No, I'm not kidding, because, you know, Orson Welles, the great director, once said that his greatest responsibility as a director was to make sure that all the best mistakes stay in the picture. You agree or disagree?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, I mean, that's when you get past a certain point of you know, sort of being free enough to appreciate that, you know, those are the moments of inspiration. Those are the moments of, oh, God, I don't know, serendipity or... Those are the great moments, and you sort of have to preserve them because that is the genius of it.
And you say, so what, from what you describe, is that you head into an adventure without a predictable finish at all. You don't plan it all out and then go to the studio, that you begin to compose and work and you hope for the big car crash.
No, not all the time. No, and I think what I'm really referring to about that is, you know, when things happen when you're playing live, you know, and somebody falls off the tracks and everybody sort of skitters around and tries to pull that person back on the track, or, you know, skitters around and fumbles through it, and then, you know, something, you know, everybody sort of sees this one exit and they head for it, you know, and it turns out to be a great idea.
I love the way you think. No, that's great stuff. And would you agree that all the best ideas start with somebody going, look, I know this sounds crazy, but...
Yeah, I guess so. I think a lot of them do. You know, I think that's what we have to take a chance, right?
Taking a chance. Talking to Deborah Harry from Blondie. Congratulations on your Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Deborah.
Thank you, David.
Thanks for giving us a call. And good luck to you on your tour. I want to come see you.
Great. Congratulations to you on your newest adventure.
Here we go. Like Columbus said, I think we're getting somewhere.
Okay. Mornings, David Lee Roth on 92.3 Free FM.
I'm wearing her pajamas. I ride up a potato. It's tickling my fancy. Speak up now, I can't tell you.
Roth Radio, going underground. Very special guest here, only the best guest here on Roth Radio. Her name is Anna Holtzman. Anna is the 29-year-old director of the new documentary called Subway Dreams. I saw it just the other night. Great, great documentary. Focuses on the lives of New York City subway musicians. What do you call them in the UK? Buskers, right?
Yep, we call them buskers down
okay.
on the tube.
And while most people think that subway performers are disorganized and potentially homeless, Anna's documentary goes to the MTA's Music Under New York program and the auditions that take there. Anna, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Are you yourself a musician?
I'm not. I'm not a musician, no.
How do you take so much interest in what's going on in the tube downstairs?
Well, I take the subway every day, and I've been doing so for about 29 years, so... I hear these musicians all the time.
And did you ever get to know somebody on a personal level that caused you to say, wow, there's a whole story behind a story here?
Once I started filming, I did. But I had no idea before I started filming, you know, about all these stories. I'd been curious. I've been taking the subway my whole life, and I see these people performing, and you kind of wonder, you know, in this huge city, you see a million faces on your way to work, and you know everyone's got a story there. So,
what are the two most interesting instruments that you've seen people playing in the subway during the whole course of the time you've been watching subway musicians?
I would have to say the one most interesting one above all was the rubber band horn.
Oh, which, the elasticized...
The elasticized Teflon that you saw in the film when you watched it. Walter Baker is the name of that musician, and he is the only person in the entire universe that plays the rubber band horn. It's a strip of Teflon, and he blows on it. It sounds like a trumpet. It's absolutely amazing.
It sounds like a Martin Scorsese New York City Taxi Driver soundtrack is what it sounds like.
Yeah, I guess so.
It alternately sounds like saxophones meet a Chinese gong, go synthesizer, and he does it with what looks like a large rubber band, a piece of rubber band. And I thought it was the most intriguing instrument of all. I'm fascinated that you would pick up on that. And yet he didn't get selected.
Right, and yet he didn't get in, which was really weird, because he was a big favorite at the Music Under New York auditions. One of the...
Well, wait, was Tom Cruise on the Judge Society there? Was Why didn't he get selected? It was the most unique and the most intriguing sound of all. Why wouldn't he have been selected?
Well, it was one of the most unique sounds, and he was highlighted on a TV program about the auditions as, like, you know, kind of a spotlight person. But he, I guess he got a letter, and Music Under New York is a great program, so I'm sure they had their reasons, but he got a letter saying that his accompaniment was too loud, which I think by accompaniment, I think they meant his, you know, he has a recording device that kind of plays back some feedback. And
oh, okay. Because his innate instrument sound was great. It's like blowing on a blade of grass times 17. Yeah. He really brought it into a symphonic kind of an arena there.
And he has such control over it, and it looks like something you wouldn't be able to control it all.
I would be shocked if somebody didn't see your documentary and hire him for a soundtrack.
That's what I'm hoping, actually. He wants to work with Bjork, in case anyone's listening who knows her.
Is Bjork a verb?
It could be.
Because that could be a sound in itself. Maybe it's automatopoetic. Maybe you play an instrument and it sounds like Bjork. Please explain to the uninitiated what the Music Under New York is.
What it is. So Music Under New York is part of Arts for Transit, which is run by the MTA. And it's kind of a guild for subway musicians. And they have a big audition. It's once a year. It happens in Grand Central Terminal. And it's kind of like American Idol, the subway version. It's like, it's really cool because on the one hand, it's like the most, you know, one of the biggest cities in the world. And the MTA is this really public institution, but at the same time, it's this real homegrown kind of thing where, you know, it's a really, really wide range of talent, and the people on the jury are everyone from, you know, really established musicians.
How do you even figure out who's on the jury? How did they select the jury for something like this?
Well, that's the funny thing is that the jury, I'm not exactly sure how they select the jury, but I know that the Music Under New York is run by one guy, and he kind of coordinates the jury. So you have really established people from, for example, Isaiah Sheffer, who's the artistic director of Symphony Space. He's on the jury almost every year, and a lot of other kind of well-known people around the city. And then you've got people who, you know, are station workers who work in subway stations, and they know what the acoustics are like, so they're on the jury. You've got other subway musicians. And then I was going around interviewing musicians, or judges, rather, at the audition, and I saw one guy's face. He looked really familiar. He actually looked like my dad, so I was like, who's that? I want to go over. And then I realized he's not my dad. He's a really good friend of my dad's who I know, and I was like, Jeffrey Metzner, what are you doing on this jury? And he's like, oh, I'm in Tai Chi class with the guy who organizes this thing, and he pulled me in at the last minute.
So there's no real format to this. Nobody knows how the jury is actually constructed, like in Colombia. Like in South America. We're not sure how the judge got selected.
South America, kind of like that. Yeah.
Okay, who's your favorite out of the entire documentary? Who's the best performer to you?
No, I couldn't pick a favorite because I totally fell in love with all of them. And I think they're all absolutely amazing musicians. Jeremiah Lockwood is one who I just think is
Describe Jeremiah to the fans here.
Jeremiah has a band called The Sway Machinery, and he plays this really amazing combination of klezmer music. He's Jewish, and his grandfather was a cantor. But he has been learning how to play bluegrass all his life, and he plays with this musician named Carolina Slim in the subways, and he somehow fuses klezmer and bluegrass together, and it sounds incredible.
Well, he's playing on the klezmer, but what he's doing is classic blues country, and you would never know that he comes from an ethnic background at all. It's Robert Johnson meets Son House times, you know, it's the Delta there. It's an interesting background that he has. How long did it take you to make the picture, Anna?
Well, it took me, from when I started, it took a year and a half. Partly that was because I've never made a film before, and so I was, you know, learning as I went along. And then I went through a few periods where I just left it alone for a few months because I was, you know, working at the same time and just kind of trying to get the guts up to finish it, so...
Well, they're artists, and you can only tolerate so much time in proximity. Talking to Anna Holtzman, who directed the documentary Subway Dreams, which focuses on all of the New York City subway musicians, or perhaps the most interesting ones. What's the strangest act that you have seen? The weirdest, the whatever.
Okay, the weirdest act is this guy named Professor Eduardo Alvarado. He's an older guy, and he's kind of hunched over, and he plays the keyboard, and he's got these little mechanical dolls that dance in front of him while he's playing, and it's just the most surreal thing ever. I went down into the subway to get a little clip of him playing, and while I was filming him, and he's playing his keyboard, it sounds kind of like an accordion, and it's like this like old sort of carnivalesque music sound. And then these two kids, like 5 years old, appear out of nowhere, and they're like, oh my God, are you filming? Is this going to be on TV? Can we, you know? So I was like, do whatever you want. And they start doing these crazy backflips and like spinning on their head and all this insane.
It's called breakdancing, darling.
Yeah. But they were like acrobatic. They were amazing. And in the background is this guy hunched over playing the keyboard with these little dolls dancing. It was really wild.
It's a surreal moment in the film here. You know what? We're going to break for spots. Can you give us one more minute? Can you got time to hang with us?
Yeah.
Because I want to know the best places to look for subway performers.
Okay.
We'll be right back after this. Oh,